to automate it.
Good morning. I'm Owen Brooks. I'm here at the Smith Robertson Museum with the Oral History Project. And I have with me this morning Mr. Louis Armstrong. And he is going to give us a little bit of his life history. And Mr. Armstrong, I have to first ask you, do I have your permission to do this interview?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Then we can proceed. Now, Mr. Armstrong, if I might call you Louis, because I've known you that long.
Yes, sir.
Give us a little about your background, where you were born, something about your parents maybe, what kind of work they may have done, and then where you first went to school. Then we will proceed from there.
Okay, well, I was born in Southwest Mississippi, a small sawmill town that once boasted as to have the largest sawmill in North America. In fact, a family in Bude, England, who owned a large sawmill there, came to Mississippi and in the Southern Pine Belt established the town of Bude, which was established around the sawmill. So the main purpose of the establishment of Bude was to support the sawmill.
What year were you born?
I was born in 1950.
1950. You want to give us the date?
August 31st, 1950.
August 31, 1950. Fine. Proceed.
In this small town, my father worked at the sawmill originally.
His name was?
His name was Charlie Armstrong. My mother's name was Lucille Armstrong. Mm-hmm. My father worked at the sawmill initially, but he was very good with mechanical things, so he ended up being the first African-American in Southwest Mississippi to be hired by the Illinois Central Railroad in the their maintenance shop, which was located in Natchez, about 30 miles away. He was considered a brakeman, which he did maintenance on the engines as they were brought in each day from their service during the day. He would refuel them, he would check the brakes and check all valve parts to make sure they were functioning and prepare them to go out for their next day's work.
Now, you had brothers and sisters, sir?
I have seven brothers and sisters. I have one brother and actually six sisters.
Six sisters and one brother. Okay, carry on.
My mother was also very extraordinary woman. She drove the first pickup truck to transport black children to school, to the public schools in Franklin County. This is the county that Bude is located in. During that time, she contracted with the Board of Education to provide transportation to the Negro children of Franklin County. And I believe, as I remember her telling me, the contract was for 3 cents per child.
3 cents per child.
To get them to school. And my father bought a pickup truck and built a wooden camper body on the back of it. And she used that to transport these children to school for a number of years until the county eventually purchased a male body school bus for the Negro students of Franklin County. So she ended up driving the school bus for 47 years.
47 years?
Yes, 47 years. And in the interim, she was a beautician. We raised most of our own food, including chickens and hogs, and had a cow for milk, and had a massive garden for all the garden products. This was in a small town of about 800 people, but it was still a lot of land available. So local people, enterprising people, did quite a bit of farming.
Of the eight children, where did you fit in?
That's interesting as well. My mother and father had four children. They waited 10 years, and they had four more.
My love.
And I'm the second one in the second set. That's how I fit into the operation. My father also became a plumber, the only plumber in the county. And so I got a chance to, my first encounter with white people was going to their houses with my father at around 5 or 6 as he worked on their indoor bathrooms. I didn't remember any black person that I knew that had an indoor bathroom in 1955. So I asked my father why did these people have indoor bathrooms, and I didn't see any in my neighborhood. And my mother immediately told me her reaction to protect me from that kind of questioning was, that is a question you do not ask. And I can remember that, and I can love her for that, for her attempt to protect me from the political consequences even then of asking such a question. Of course, I did not heed her wishes and continued to be curious about the disparity between the people who lived on the other side of the track. Because there was the
Was there a lot of hostility track. Was between the races at that time?
Well, it wasn't much hostility. It was oppression and submission. There was no open hostility by black folk, particularly in Franklin County, that has a particularly cruel history of racism and oppression.
What was the first school you attended, sir?
First school I attended was Lily Mae Bryant.
Okay. Was that in Franklin County?
Lily Mae Bryant School.
Lily Mae Bryant.
Located in Franklin County.
Okay.
The school, again, was a relatively new school by the time I came along. Until then, actually until 1949, most of the black children in Franklin County went to one-room rural schools located in close to their particular communities. Most of them, a few went to the consolidated school located between Butte and Meadville. By the time I came to school in 1956, there was a brand new brick elementary school, through high school, that was named Lily Mae Bryant. And that was my first attendance. Mrs. Oney Mae Webster and Mrs. Ethel Lee Cameron were my first and second grade teachers. And
how many grades were there in that school, sir?
There were 6 grades in that school.
6 grades in that school. All right. And did all your siblings attend the same school in Franklin County? Did they, at least in the...
Yes, they all attended
your the same.
Except that prior to 1949, to finish high school, you had to leave Franklin County.
Oh.
The Franklin County schools went to the 8th grade until 1950.
Okay.
They then implemented a high school curriculum. Prior to that time, they had only elementary and middle school.
Now, where was the high school curriculum located?
There were high schools located in Natchez, Vicksburg, Laurel, Macomb, in that particular area that we have attended. So the practice was that many children who had relatives or knew someone, or had friends in these towns, the parents would send them to stay with these relatives or or friends to complete high school in the rare occasions that they could afford to pay for that that child's education in those other places. So at least two of my sisters left, had to finish high school in other counties other than Franklin County. But the rest of my siblings, we all graduated from high school there in Franklin County.
In Franklin County? Mm-hmm. What was the name of the high school?
It was Lily Mae Bryant.
Oh, that was elementary.
It was elementary and high school.
Okay.
They gave us one.
1 to 12.
Yeah.
All right. Now, so you graduated high school. What year is it? You finished high school?
1968. 68. Yes, sir. A couple of months after, actually 1 month after Martin Luther King was shot.
Were you aware of what was going on in Mississippi and in other places as related to the movement?
I was very much aware. I was very much aware. I read constantly about the and intently watched the news about events that were happening in the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in fact. When the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated, this is in 68, mm-hmm. the school system was experimenting with integration.
Okay.
So they had one white teacher at Lily Mae Bryant High School, and they had sent one, our best white teacher, a black teacher from our school to the white school, but they sent a rather mediocre teacher to
where was the white
our
school.
Where was the white school was about 2 miles away.
What was its name?
In Meadville.
In Meadville?
Uh-huh. It was Franklin High School.
Okay. In Meadville.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you finished in 68?
Yes, sir.
And where did you head?
I headed to Jackson State.
From there?
I headed to Jackson State. Traditionally, students from Southwest Mississippi went to Allcorn.
Mm.
So 6 of my classmates out of a class of 48,
mm-hmm.
We had a total graduating class of 48. 6 of my fellow students and I, or 5 of my fellow students came to Jackson State.
Mm-hmm.
And we considered ourselves breaking the mold and not going to Alcorn.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I had a sister who had my older sister, that's immediately older than I am, 2 years older than I am, had come to Jackson State and was, in fact, in the band at Jackson State.
Your older sister.
Mm-hmm. So I fell in love with Jackson State on my visit there, and you know, look forward to attending it. So I came to Jackson State in August of 1968 at 17.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, during that time, you were asked to bring a footlocker with all your possessions in it.
Mm-hmm.
My mother put me out in front of Stewart Hall and with my footlocker and told me that she had to be back home before dark and to do well, and left me standing on the sidewalk, and I can remember that day very well because I felt quite terrified being left on the sidewalk at Jackson State.
Now, what about tuition? How did you all manage that?
My mother was quite an entrepreneur. She she came up with a restaurant nightclub.
Oh my goodness.
To pay my sister's tuition that wasn't paid by scholarship. My sister was a straight A student, so she was on scholarship to Jackson State.
Mm-hmm.
I was not a straight A student.
Mm.
So I ended up getting a Pell Grant And for the other resources I needed, I ended up getting a working in the cafeteria at Jackson State to pay on the student work program.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the resources came from my mother, who purchased a building and had it relocated and opened a nightclub and restaurant.
Where was it?
This was across the street from my home, our home in Butte.
In Butte. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And of course, Butte was a dry county.
Oh, really?
Right. Which I didn't know until I was 15 that it was a dry county.
Okay. Did that present a little bit of a problem?
Well, no, it really didn't, because the sheriff was on the take. You just paid the sheriff, and you could you could bootleg with me.
Right.
Openly, with a neon sign that said, actually, my mother catered to, tried to cater to younger people and not get into the business of bootlegging, but the competition there was such that you really couldn't stay in business unless you were in that kind of selling whiskey. And she eventually succumbed to selling the temptation of staying in business, and ended up allowing another person under some kind of contractual agreement she had that he could sell whiskey on the premises.
Mm.
So until the other nightclubs who were, it was very successful business, and for 3 or 4 years it was really successful.
Lucrative.
It was very lucrative, and we were able to go to school and during that time, though, the other clubs allegedly got together and paid the sheriff a little bit more than my mother was paying him, and the guy who was selling the whiskey there eventually got arrested for selling whiskey, and then she shut that business down.
Now, I take it you stayed on campus, is that right?
I stayed on campus.
Okay.
I stayed on campus at
did you go home weekend?
Went home usually one weekend out of a month.
Okay. And what did you major in school?
I majored in social studies, history, and I fluctuated between history and political science, having decided in the eighth grade that I wanted a life of public service.
Mm.
I did a paper on Carl T. Rowan, who was appointed by Nixon, or Eisenhower, I believe Eisenhower, to be information officer, United States information officer. This was a title of basically providing whatever policy statements the government wanted to put out, he was type them up and send them out or something.
Okay.
But I looked at his career and his influence, and I was
who was this?
Carl T. Rowan.
Carl Rowan.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was so thrilled to see this black man appointed to such an important high-ranking job that in the government, and so I believe that through the government that people's conditions could be changed, that situations could be improved for all Americans through the governmental process.
Okay.
So I focused on a career of public service, and in order to do that, I needed to understand history as well as political science. So I ended up graduating with a major in history and political science.
Mm-hmm. And what year did you graduate?
Actually, I graduated in 1975, which was delayed by 2 years in 2 years in the military and 1 year.
Tell us about that. When did
Malcolm
you go in?
I also attended Malcolm X Community College in Chicago.
Oh, okay. So, at what point you went in the military?
I went in the military in 1972.
Mm, okay.
after a stint at Malcolm X College in Chicago, I was under a deferment. I had been doing, that was doing the draft, and actually I was drafted. I got my draft number my freshman year at Jackson State. My after the riots at Jackson State, a member of the administration said that they knew I had some involvement in it, and was fully prepared to investigate if I returned to school that fall. So I left Jackson State. That summer I went to Chicago to work.
That was the summer of 72?
That was the summer of 69.
Summer of 69?
Mm-hmm.
What, you went to Chicago to work?
To work. But I had I had not told my mother that I was under the instructions by the administration not to return to Jackson State.
Mm.
I had been engaged in two attempts to burn down the ROTC building.
Oh, Lord.
Fellow classmate and I, who is now a medical doctor in the Air Force. We made a, I guess you would call it, immature attempt to burn down the ROTC building.
On campus?
On campus. Two nights in a row.
Mm.
And failed both times.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So off to Chicago?
Yeah.
And you stayed, did you have relatives there?
I had a sister in Chicago. So I lived with her for a few weeks and was able to get my own apartment and go to work at Brock's Candy Company.
Okay.
And so in order to satisfy my mother, because she was totally upset that I was not coming back to Jackson State, I enrolled that fall in Malcolm X College.
Mm-hmm.
And I sought a deferment through the local draft board in Franklin County.
Uh-huh.
Which was denied.
I guess.
Right. Due to my attendance at Malcolm X College, which they did not recognize. So for the next year, I fought with the draft board about my eligibility for a deferment, and then after I was selected to serve in the greatest fighting force in the world, the United States Army, I informed them in a 3-page letter that my friends and neighbors had not participated in my selection. As the letter states, your friends, greetings, your friends and neighbors have selected you to serve in the greatest fighting force in the world, etc. And I went on to explain how my friends and neighbors had not been involved in the selection process, which they ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI came around to visit.
Do you remember when that was, Nat? What year was that?
That was in 71.
In 71.
Because I was originally supposed to report.
1971.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I was originally supposed to report in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not. So I ended up reporting in late 1971, October of 1971, after a visit by the FBI, informing me that another draft letter would be sent, and if I did not respond, I would be immediately arrested for draft evasion. Of course, my mother got word of that incident and immediately began her campaign to make sure that I went into the service. And I put at Malcolm X, there was an atmosphere of draft resistance,
anti-war,
and anti-war demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in all of those movements there, and I had gotten, they had set up attorneys and counselors and all of that to assist me in my in my determination not to participate in an illegal war and an immoral war. So I found the conscientious objector status. And that allowed me.
You filed for that?
I filed for the conscientious objector. I ended up going in the service, and there was a provision in the service that you could file even after, even serving, while serving in the so I ended up, I was asked to become an officer, even after.
After having been drafted.
After having been drafted.
As being an anti-war
I was asked, my test scores indicated that I could master that process, so they asked me to be an officer, which I refused. And so they sent me to the MOS, that's
the special
you're involved in, and I was sent to...
They sent you to school?
They assigned you an
MOS?
They assigned me an MOS of a combat engineer. So my graduation from AIT required me to disarm a Claymore mine. But after graduation...
Where were you stationed?
I was stationed for advanced training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Missouri, oh yeah.
Which was my first encounter with outright object racism.
Fort Leonard Wood. Okay, and you went to school at Fort Leonard Wood?
I went to school there and graduated in, as a combat engineer.
And then you were assigned to a unit?
I was assigned to a unit in Kansas, Fort Riley, Kansas.
Fort Riley. So what kind of a unit?
It was a infantry unit, preparing for a duty in Germany. But due to the racism in the military at the time, there was a large number of young men coming back from Vietnam. We're in 1972, late 1972 now, the end of the war, the scaling down of the war in Vietnam. So we're seeing a lot of young African American men coming back who were drafted. Went to training and went immediately to Vietnam.
They would never send me to school because of my activity.
They would not?
No, they assigned me an MOS. I was in supply. I was in supply sergeant.
Okay.
In the AAA gun battalion in 1951.
In 1951, that was in the Korean War.
Korean War. I'm 78 years old.
The same thing, okay. That's amazing.
So your background parallels mine as far as military is concerned. They followed me all the way through.
Well, you might, if mine got a little more difficult.
Okay, carry on.
Well, I ended up, because I had some college, and most of these young men, remember during that particular time, at 18, when you hit draft age at 18, most of the military were made up of 18, 19, 21-year-old guys who had went straight from high school to the military and through after being drafted or even volunteering when there were no jobs available. And during that time, there was also a provision that if you had any kind of misdemeanor criminal charges, you could volunteer for the Army in exchange for dropping criminal charges.
Right.
A lot of black, young black males ended up, particularly from the gangs in Chicago and Detroit, New York, ended up in the military as a result of that. So these were the guys that were coming back from Vietnam. And they were being, there was outright racism, being called nigger by Southern sergeants who were also coming back from Vietnam and frustrated about how much authority blacks had in Vietnam because they were first on the firing line and most courageous in combat, that you would find that there was this animosity when they got back to the United States. And there was hundreds of cases of just outright discrimination and racism by these and provoking these young men into situations where they would violate some military code. Mm-hmm. So I became the jailhouse lawyer at Fort Riley.
At Fort Riley in Kansas?
Right. Okay. Because I'd had some colleagues, these guys would come to me and ask me what to do about a letter or some kind of incident that they were involved in. Mm-hmm. I would read the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I became quite an expert at the UCMJ and helped them with their cases. So I became sort of like the jailhouse lawyer. And from that, I got to know a lot of guys. And we requested through a letter to the Congressional Black Caucus an investigation into racism in the military. This was right after the Kitty Hawk incident in 1972. There was an incident on the Kitty Hawk out in the Atlantic where there was a race riot actually on the Kitty Hawk. Kitty Hawk was a naval ship that was stationed out somewhere near Vietnam. After that incident, the Congressional Black Caucus responded to our letter and conducted a hearing on racism in the military. Louis Stokes, who was chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, actually came to Fort Riley at our request to review the racism at the fort. He came in and he did not meet with us, but he wrote us and told us he was coming and told us he was going to be meeting with the general, and they had a ceremony for him that day, and he then told us he would be following up with the information that he had been provided.
Okay.
So
what year was that now?
That was 1972.
Okay. Carry on. Now, you were still at Fort Riley?
Yes. I was never moved from Fort Riley.
You spent your whole tour?
My whole tour at Fort Riley. They wouldn't send me anywhere else.
Okay.
We ended up, because of the need to organize and to protect ourselves from the racism at Fort Riley, we ended up organizing a group called Black Brothers United. Of which I was chairperson. Mm-hmm. Well, the Central Intelligence Division of the military, the CID as we called it, came and was informed us that our organizing should cease and desist, or we would be all arrested and charged with treason. So we had a we pondered for about a week and stayed pondering what to do. So we changed our name to Concerned Brothers for Sickle Cell Anemia. It happened that a young lady at one of the clubs that we would frequent on the weekend had sickle cell. She was a waitress and she had sickle cell anemia. And she would be out sick quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And we became familiar with the problem through her. We had heard of, many of us had heard about sickle cell anemia, but we didn't know the consequences. And it was a very painful disease, and it was she was out more frequently as time went on, and so we saw it was a debilitating disease as well. So we organized around educating people about sickle cell anemia, and we still could conduct our political meetings. And so that was my encounter. And I, in fact, at one point, I was followed 24 hours a day by the Central Intelligence Division. Not only myself, but at least three of the other leaders involved in this group were followed 24 hours a day.
By the CID?
Mm-hmm.
I'm familiar with that. Okay. Now, in total, how long did you spend in the military?
2 years.
Okay, and you were given a discharge when?
I was given an honorable discharge to return to Jackson State in September of
74.
Mm-hmm. September
73.
I returned to Jackson State, and I graduated in 75 from Jackson State.
Now, when you left the service, did you have any reserve responsibility?
No. Huh? I was listed as, you were supposed to have 6 years of reserve requirements if you would elect to sign up.
Mm-hmm.
Mississippi, because they had such a large number of reservists, was mm-hmm. not a state that required mandatory signing up.
It was mandatory when I left in 53.
Okay, well, it wasn't when I came.
I had five and two. I had 5 years in the inactive after I left active duty in 1953. And then about 2 years later, they gave me this job.
Well, the Army didn't want to see me anymore after my tenure with them. I was glad to leave them, and they were glad to see me go. So
okay. Now, answer me a question. Did you ever serve in an integrated unit?
Yes, it was integrated.
The unit was integrated. Mm-hmm. I never served in the integrated unit.
Okay. Yeah. The whole thing was integrated.
September 73. Mm-hmm. And then you returned to JSU. All right. And, let's see, upon your return, what happened?
Upon my return, I got active in the Veterans Club.
Mm-hmm.
My plan...
What was that? Explain that.
The Veterans Club was a group of Vietnam-era veterans who were organized into a sort of a political club, you might say. It was actually supposed to be a social club. The school wanted it to be more of a social club.
Social club.
But of course, we immediately became political mm-hmm. in the sense that we invited Stokely Carmichael to campus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at Jackson State in 73, that was a no-no.
Mm-hmm.
So the SGA, the way the student government works is the SGA is designated as a student representative. They get the funding for events to bring different speakers to campus.
Right.
It has to be approved by the SGA along with the administration.
Okay.
We applied to the SGA for $2,500 to bring Stokely on for a forum and then a speech.
Mm-hmm.
This was around homecoming. We found that because of the way we found out about the fund, of which it was kind of a hush-hush deal,
mm-hmm.
The local student paper published that the OJs were coming for the homecoming dance,
mm-hmm.
and that the student SGA was paying them $10,000 to come for the homecoming dance. So we said we could get $2,500 from them for Stokely Carmichael.
Mm-hmm.
It made sense to us.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we were denied the $2,500.
They wouldn't give you the $2,500?
They wouldn't give us the $2,500. And that turned into a very bitter struggle with the SGA mm-hmm. leadership, which we called House Negroes at the time.
Mm.
And it got into a, culminated in our appeal to the administration, believe it or not. Of course, we were denied there as well. And, but we raised such a ruckus about it that they gave us $1,500. So we had a series of car washes
mm-hmm.
to raise the other $1,000 that we needed for Stokely to come to campus.
Mm-hmm.
And it created quite a bit of unity among the veterans. That was the biggest thing that it did. So it helped us the next year mm-hmm. when the Ayers case came about.
Okay.
This lawyer showed up on campus in a well-worn suit.
Well, first of all, did Stokely come for the 1500?
He came.
He came.
He came. Yes, he came. He decided to come to he came to Tougaloo and to Jackson State the same weekend, which mm-hmm. was a way to supplement the fact that we were a little short.
Right. Okay, that's good. All right, and then you said the next year somebody came to the campus.
Ike Madison.
Ike Madison. I say.
Ike Madison showed up in a well-worn suit.
Oh yeah, good old Ike.
with shoes a little worn out themselves,
mm-hmm.
And a briefcase with papers flying. And he asked us to join in his case.
Mm-hmm.
And we were immediately responded by joining and supporting the lawsuit to end discrimination in funding for institutions of higher learning in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
We found out that the administration had discouraged students from signing on as plaintiffs.
Mm-hmm.
So the sororities and the fraternities were unresponsive to the request for student plaintiffs in the case. So I contacted the Veterans Club at Allcorn mm-hmm. and at Mississippi Valley.
Okay.
And we had a we had a meeting on the Natchez Trace.
Uh-huh.
On the Natchez Trace Parkway. We had a weekend barbecue throwdown political meeting. And we decided that we would hold this, we would organize each campus with prospective plaintiffs and bring them to Jackson State for a big rally. We would each have a small rally on our own campus, mm-hmm. and then we'd have a big, massive rally of all the students from the three schools at Jackson State University.
Mm-hmm. It was going to be at JSU?
Mm-hmm.
A mass meeting.
And they agreed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a beautiful thing because, you know, Jackson State and Allcorn and Valley had been known for the athletic rivalries, but never having come together on anything of substance.
Right.
So we thought that it was a beautiful thing to come together on something of substance. And we had this rally, and Ike Madison spoke, and a couple of the veteran leaders spoke, and we signed up several students that day as plaintiffs. Ike did, as plaintiffs in the case. And of course, the rest is history. The Ayers case went on for a number of years until it was recently settled.
Let's see this. Yes. Okay. All right. What have you got to say about the? About your involvement in that effort down through the years. I guess it took, let's see,
27 years.
What year did they organize? 74?
Yes, it was
74, I remember that. And it went on till
97. I mean, no, actually 98.
Long time.
It took 27 years to get a court, to get the Supreme Court to rule definitively
mm-hmm.
on the Ayers case.
Right.
So that was the most important period of time
mm-hmm.
For my involvement in the case, centered around keeping it alive, continuing to keep the litigation going.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the attorneys changed, but and somewhat the direction of the case changed. The Justice Department tried to derail the whole thing with their inclusion of integration as an issue. It was, integration was never an issue in
the an issue in the original pleading.
It was never an issue. The equalization of funding was the issue for black schools and for white schools. That was the issue. Never integration. But the Justice Department intervened in 98.
Now, you being an original plaintiff, right, you had probably the knowledge of the whole history of the case as one of the original plaintiffs that followed the case down through the years.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you weren't involved, you're saying, in the final settlement. That didn't mean you weren't in the knowledge.
I was knowledgeable of the manner in which it was settled, but I was not consulted at all.
Explain what you understood. Go ahead.
Well, the settlement was far less than what we asked for. Mm-hmm. It was far less than what we were demanding. In monetary value, we were asking for $1.4 billion. Based on a very sound fiscal analysis of the amount of funds that were needed to correct the past historical discrimination in funding that had occurred.
Right.
And this was done by educational experts from around the country. This was not some haphazard number that we came up with.
Now, just for the record, the original request, you originally sought how much?
$1.4
billion. Okay, $1.4 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And the final settlement, how far away was that?
The final settlement is anywhere between, it fluctuates anywhere between 500 to 700 million. Depending on who you ask about it.
Okay. And who was, of the original plaintiffs, usually the attorneys consult with the plaintiffs about the proposed settlement.
Well, by then a new attorney had been appointed.
Right. I know that. You go ahead and talk about it.
The original attorneys, or the attorney of long standing in the case of 20 years or more, had been essentially removed from the case by the judges, the federal judges, and in place was appointed Isaac Byrd.
So, Al Chambliss.
Al Chambliss was removed.
Was removed, okay. As the representative of the plaintiff.
As the representative of the plaintiff.
Okay. Was that easily done, or that took some time, didn't
it? It took some time. It went through a proceeding and a federal judge.
Mm-hmm. Alright. And even after he had been removed, he did not drop his interest in the suit,
nor has he dropped it to this day. He's still actively involved in an aspect of the case that will be known in the future.
Okay, and there will be another appeal, you expect?
No, actually, we can't appeal it.
You can't appeal.
What we can do is a new lawsuit based on the violation of the terms of the agreement.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that will be in the name of you and other named plaintiffs?
Yes, I would expect.
As part of your claim, misrepresentation by the lawyers, by Byrd, who took over?
No.
That he didn't represent your interest?
No, I don't think we're going to. That has been attempted. That case has been, or a claim has been presented to the courts, and it's been rejected by the court.
Mm-hmm.
So that would not be the focus.
Okay, what's your feeling? You can tell me what your... what you think of the settlement, how it got subverted in the manner in which it was, and who represented who. I've heard a number of stories. I have even heard that Byrd received a payment in large sum to agree to the settlement that was finally agreed to. Can you corroborate that in any kind of way?
I saw numbers of around $250,000,
mm-hmm,
as his fee for in that particular case. Mm.
What about the other plaintiff?
The only other plaintiff that was involved in the settlement was Congressman Benny Thompson.
Ben.
He was brought in to make the settlement, to do the settlement.
Was he an original plaintiff?
He was an original plaintiff.
I thought he was. Yeah.
Yes, he was an original plaintiff.
Did he agree to the settlement?
Yes, he agreed to the settlement.
I didn't.
You didn't.
No, a lot of us didn't.
He didn't consult you, did he?
No.
Definitely
not. We never even had a meeting.
Never had a meeting.
Of the Concerned Citizens,
no.
Group that we had organized way back in 74.
No.
It just seemed to disappear and had no... no involvement in the proceedings at all, and did not have an opportunity to voice its sentiment. I met a couple of times with what's his name at Jackson State?
Dr. Phillips and McInnes, probably McInnes, young English professor, I believe he was. But Dr. Phillips is...
Ivory was the main one that we met with.
There was a recent summit on the Ayers case.
It was?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
It was the quietest summit I have ever heard of. The public was not invited. The media was not invited.
And who called that?
Ike Madison.
Hmm. Do you remember how long that was?
It was in April.
Hmm. April of 2006?
Yes.
Just a couple of months ago?
Yes.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Did you go?
Yes,
you
participated.
Yeah, that's interesting.
They had some plaintiffs. The congressman was involved. Dr. McLemore. Some of the administrators from Alcorn and Valley.
Ivy
was not invited.
Ivy wasn't invited.
No.
And what was the purpose of the summit? Allegedly.
Allegedly, it was to review what where AIRS is. I don't really quite know for sure what the situation is, but that was to review where we are with AIRS case.
And who called it?
Well, Ike Madison is working under a contract for the political science department at Jackson State. You know, the most important thing, though, that came out of this summit is that there is no monitoring mechanism to ensure that even the mediocre settlement that we did get out of AIRS, that is being honored by the state of Mississippi.
It's not being monitored.
It's not being monitored, and there's no measurement of the compliance. Because actually, the state is not in compliance.
So the terms of the settlement
has no monitoring mechanism. For those who agreed to the settlement, they agreed not to have a monitoring mechanism.
Damn. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
It's like it's gone, it's buried right here. AIRS is over, let's bury it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly the state's wish.
Forget about it.
Yeah. What do you see, if anything, happening from this point?
I see that there is going to be an effort to get a mechanism to monitor AIRS, and then through that mechanism we will end up going back to court because the state has violated the terms of even the less than appropriate agreement we do have.
And who leads this? Who is to lead this effort?
It's going to have to come out of a new group, some younger students, some of the original plaintiffs, some of the retired educators.
Mm. Will you be involved?
Yes, sir.
You will? Well, I'd like to know of a meeting that
okay.
I could come to.
Okay.
I would
okay.
definitely. Okay. Now, let's go back a pace, because you have done a lot of other things. I know that you were involved with the legal service, what was it?
The Legal Services Coalition.
Okay. Tell us how that came to be.
The Legal Services Coalition was a state support center established by the six legal services programs in Mississippi to provide training and coordination of policy and services through the six legal services programs. We were also established to do lobbying and policy analysis and impact litigation.
Mm-hmm. And when was that organized?
It was organized in 1976.
Okay, you said lobbying, policy analysis, and what else?
And impact litigation.
Impact litigation. thing.
Actually, it was organized in 1978.
78?
Yes, sir, 78. They started in 76, but it finally culminated in a legal entity in 78.
Okay. All right. 1978. Okay, and how long did you stay with that?
I stayed with the Legal Services Coalition from 1980 to 1995.
And that was located here in Jackson. Okay. Did you have a staff and an office, et cetera?
We had a staff and of attorneys. I had one attorney, at least one attorney. Sometimes there was two attorneys. I had a training coordinator, and I had a policy analyst. So the office was fully staffed to provide the services that I described. I was director from 1985 until
1995. All right. And describe some of the high points. What kinds of work that you did in that?
We returned over $200 million to Entergy customers for overcharges by Entergy. We sued utility companies for overcharging poor consumers, low income consumers. One of the I could go into detail about those issues, but they would have to do with the utility charging lower income consumers to subsidize research or other kinds of technology that would impact a smaller number of higher income or even private sector businesses. In fact, at one point there was the phone company used an increase in pay phones to subsidize research on business technology, improving technology to business. So we sued him and won that case, and won another one that had to do with Entergy and the Grand Gulf nuclear plant. We were opposed to the construction of the Grand Gulf nuclear plant in southwest Mississippi. And we ended up getting a substantial amount of the expense for construction shifted out of the responsibility of Mississippi Entergy consumers.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did this put you in direct opposition to the Public Service Commission?
Yes, to the Public Service Commission, and more importantly, to the utility company support base.
Okay. Utility company. So they must have done everything to put you all out of business.
Oh, yes, they did. In fact, the current lawyer that is being considered for the federal bench for Mississippi, Mike Wallace, is credited with putting the Legal Services Coalition out of business.
And he is about to be?
He's been about to be appointed to the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. The famous conservative racist Fifth Circuit.
Oh, yes.
The greatest thing that the Legal Services Coalition accomplished was doubling the number of black elected officials in Mississippi.
How did they...
A story yet untold.
Tell it.
We, in 1980, when the census came out, the census was done every 10 years, so mm-hmm. when the 1980 census was produced, the coalition started off with an educational program. We were going to inform local citizens about the census and tell them what their rights were under reapportionment, that they had a right to have their counties reapportioned based on the fair representation. So in the course of that, these county leaders and community organizations said to us, we need more than that. We need for you to analyze these plans that are being presented and draw us an alternative plan if needed. And of course, this was totally not what we had prepared to commit to do.
Right.
It could require a substantial amount of funding to do such a project. And I met quite a bit of resistance on my legal services board about taking it on, but the board heard what the people wanted. They heard the people's need and cry for help, and the local leaders back in the counties and at the local school boards and at the local towns across the state. And we found the money to establish the process. So it ended up on me that I was a coordinator for that project, so I ended up having to learn how to draw political districts. Senator Henry Kirksey gave me some assistance in learning how to draw these districts. And from there, I went out to local government, and we ended up challenging 40 redistricting plans, and submitting our own plan to the Department of Justice. In 39 cases, we won.
Okay, now, what kinds of districts were these? Municipal, legislative, congressional,
It started off with the county districts, because yeah. in the reapportionment process and in the electoral process after the 80 census, the next election that was coming up was the county election.
Mm-hmm.
So the county reapportionment started. So we had to attack that process. After the county elections come the local elections.
Local being municipal?
Municipal election. So we had to follow up with a whole new campaign to address the municipal election. And we're quite successful.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, you had black attorneys who had a commitment to civil rights cases.
Mm-hmm.
So I had Victor McTeer, I had Margaret Carey, I had Ellis Turnage, and Carol Rhodes were attorneys who, and Alvin Chambliss, he took a couple of cases, who would agree to take these cases if I would come in and prove that we could create more black districts. And they would take the cases and file an injunction to stop the election or to file a complaint with the Justice Department during the review process. The Justice Department initially, Jesse Jackson was even helpful in this process. We brought him in to get involved, because we had raised the thing about the 1980 redistricting for the county level is that county in 1965, Ole Miss developed what's called the equal road mileage theory for county government. In anticipation of passage of the Voting Rights Act,
Ole Miss came up with this equal road mileage theory that required that you had to have equal road miles in each of the five districts within a county, supervisory districts within a county.
Mm-hmm.
Well, essentially what this equal road mileage did was fragment the black vote.
Mm-hmm.
Each local district would come in and pick up a portion of the black vote and spread it out among the five districts on the theory of the equal road mileage.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a smokescreen for discriminatory redistricting. So in 1975, the state legislature required counties to go to the unit system.
Yeah.
Remember that?
I do remember that. Yep.
To go get away from each supervisor managing its own district and having to have centralizing county
administration. Right.
In 75. This was a government reform movement of 75, included that. So by 1980, there was no need for equal road mileage.
Mm-hmm.
But yet the counties were still arguing under the redistricting program that they needed equal road mileage in each district.
Mm.
Of course, now we threw it right out of the window when we drew Kate. I ignored the equal road mileage theory altogether,
mm-hmm.
and drew districts that reflected the communities of interest. We called them communities of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And when you drew plans that reflected communities of interest, for instance, I'll take a county like Jones County. Jones County was about 35% black, okay? Couldn't elect a supervisor, never had a black supervisor. Well, if you draw a district based on communities of interest,
mm-hmm.
you create two black supervisory districts.
Okay, explain that just a little more.
Communities of interest is if a community lives on one side of the river in a county, on the eastern part of the county,
mm-hmm.
say a community lives in the eastern part, let's take a more easily more identifiable county is Heidelberg. That's I can't think of the county's name right now, but in that particular county, the county is strangely divided into two different entities. On the eastern side of the county, you have the black population. It's majority black, overwhelmingly black. On the western side of the county, divided by a railroad, believe it or not, the whole county is,
mm-hmm.
you have a substantially white population, actually divided by a railroad and the interstate, now the interstate. Interstate 59, it goes down through Meridian, down to the coast, divided. So but the districts, the supervisory districts, you had no black districts. Because they were based on this equal road mileage theory, they would go all over, they would go into the east counties and make sure the population was dispersed. So when you just substantially draw a county district, we ended up with three black majority districts and two white majority districts.
In that particular county.
Because we simply used the natural dividing line, communities of interest. We use natural boundaries because that way it was easier for persons who were not familiar with county line to easily identify with where they were, where they should be voting, what area they should be voting in. And it's one of the recognized principles of redistricting in the Voting Rights Act, natural boundaries.
Natural boundaries.
Like a stream, like a street, mm-hmm. like a highway, like a railroad track, things like that. So we used those kinds of things as well, and we ended up creating these districts.
Mm.
So we doubled the number of black elected supervisors.
In that fashion?
In that fashion. And we doubled the number of black, actually we ended up impact doubling the number of black municipal elected officials and tripling the number of female elected officials.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a double impact in the municipal sense, in that you have a, because the municipal races are really ceremonial in many cases in these little small towns, mm-hmm. so you get a lot of females running for these kind of jobs. So we ended up actually tripling the number of females that were elected. Many of them came to that first, the first Mississippi Municipal Association meeting after the redistricting process was around, was in 85. Because see, many of these cases ended up, we ended up going to court and ended up injunctions on elections and the whole process. So by 85, everything had been settled,
mm-hmm.
including the redistricting in Hinds County, which I got elected to the city council in 85.
Okay.
As a result of all of the furor around changing the municipal district, Hinds County changed the district here. The city of Jackson changed the district in the city. We went from a...
Was that part of the effort to change the form, the system of election in the city of Jackson?
No, it was not. It was a separate part. That was the change in the form of government in Jackson was an older process that had been going on since the mid-70s.
Oh, right.
And this new redistricting process that the Legal Services Coalition got involved in was, mm-hmm. was new to the reapportionment conducted in the 80s.
Okay, so it wasn't part of that.
No, but it just so happened that the Supreme Court decision around the impact of the Voting Rights Act
mm-hmm.
came out in 82, when the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized in 82, there was a new provision added. It was called intent. Prior to 82, a plaintiff had to prove that the government intended to harm a black voter. After 82, the Voting Rights Act stipulated that the impact of the policy was enough, that intent did not have to be proven, but that the impact of the policy was enough to require change.
Oh, didn't have to change, didn't have to prove intent.
You didn't have to have a record to show that some racist legislator got up and said, we want to draw this district this way in order to keep blacks from getting elected.
Right.
Prior to 82, you had to have some smoking gun, some intent.
Mm-hmm.
After 82, the measuring stick was the impact. Significant difference.
Okay.
So that was after the 82 reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. So that helped municipal redistricting cases throughout the nation and changed the whole picture of redistricting.
Right.
And therefore, when the Supreme Court, there was of course a challenge to the 82 provision, and by the time it was 84 before the Supreme Court ruled on it. So in 84, when the Supreme Court ruled on it, Jackson knew then, and most municipalities knew then, that it was challenging the Voting Rights Act,
mm-hmm.
knew that they had lost it, and Jackson voluntarily changed its government in 84. So the election was scheduled for 85.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
1984.
And a lot of these other local municipalities were in court waiting on a judgment on this same issue.
Yeah.
Because the basis of our redistricting was the impact. And we would show, I would do research on the impact of discriminatory redistricting. For instance, I would look at the hospital board, I would look at the Board of Education, I would look at the representation on the any civic board that the county or local government created, any kind of board to administer the Arts Alliance board. I would look at all of those boards and show the black representation on there, and it would reflect the black elected official representation. Mm-hmm. If there were no black elected officials, you had none on there.
Right.
Or at most, you had one token. So, as a part of my arguments to the Justice Department, we would include all of this information, socioeconomic data, we called it. And out of that, the Justice Department concluded that there was the impact of these districts was discriminatory, and they ruled in our favor. And in fact, the Justice Department would refer to our plan when they rejected local government plan. They would refer to our plan. And we ended up winning a lot of cases like that throughout the state.
Okay.
That was the Legal Services Coalition's greatest
greatest accomplishment.
I think so.
Good. Thank you, Lewis. That's very good. Now, you were elected to the City Council in what year?
In 1985.
All right. Let's see now. How did that fit with, in 85, the redistricting of the City of Jackson that occurred in 1970, what?
Well, the redistricting had occurred in 84, actually, when the city voluntarily agreed to move from the commissioner form.
That's what I...
They had two commissioners and a mayor.
Right. Okay, that's what I was... what I was trying to...
They voluntarily agreed in between 83 and 84, and in the early 84, a committee was formed to recommend a new form of government.
Okay.
By midsummer of 84, that new form of government had been recommended, and by the fall, the election had been set for 85.
Okay. A new form of government. That was the commissioners versus the city council.
Yeah.
The mayor city council.
Mm-hmm. It was a two-person commission with the mayor versus a seven-minute member of city council with a mayor.
And it was replaced. Okay, and the first election of the new, seven council districts?
Yeah.
Occurred?
In June of 1985.
Okay. Let me think. Who ran for mayor?
So actually, we ended up with three blacks and four white members of the city council.
Okay, that's good. Three blacks.
And one of those white members was considered the swing district. There were three majority black districts, four majority white districts, and one swing district created in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
The swing district was 50% white, 50% black.
Okay. And is that the way it played out? There were three blacks elected, four whites elected.
Uh-huh.
And who was elected in the swing district?
Margaret Barrett.
Okay, she's white. Okay.
and the mayor, incumbent mayor, was reelected.
Who was that?
Dale Danks.
Danks. And is this what we're living with right now?
Yes. Yeah, the district.
Pretty much the same.
Pretty much the same. No, they're not the same. There are now four overwhelmingly black districts and the swing district.
Four?
Actually, there are five white black districts. In the swing district, I'm sorry, five white districts, black districts, and the swing district, and one white district. Through the early 70s up through the 90s, you had substantial white flight to the suburbs.
Okay, now the first black mayor was elected in
1994.
No, I'm sorry. No, he
wasn't. That's Harvey. Yeah, the first black mayor was elected in
97.
He ran in
94, but lost. Okay. And they proceeded to elect. Five and two, right?
Mm-hmm.
Five blacks and two whites.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Paradigm shifted.
Harvey served two terms, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Two terms. All right. What else can you add for me? How we got to this sorry situation we're in now with city government. It certainly is a sorry situation. I know you agree with that.
Well, you know, the power structure in this town never accepted black involvement in the political process.
They sure.
Never accepted it to this
white power.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The old traditional.
The old money. Traditional leadership has mm-hmm. never accepted legitimate black political power.
Right.
They prefer pseudo black political power, the mm-hmm. the semblance of power without the substance.
Right.
They endorse those Negroes that buy into the semblance of power mm-hmm. and shy away from the substance of power. And at this point, the pendulum has shifted to that else to those Negroes and those white folk who still maintain the belief that they know better about how to run the politics of the city.
Okay, how does that translate? Well, that with the departure of Harvey's administration, okay, real black power has receded
in the mayor's office. We can separate the mayor's office and the council.
Okay.
The council has had less. During my tenure as president of the council,
mm-hmm.
was the period when we had consolidation of black power on the council.
Now that would, putting it chronologically, that would be 19 what?
That would be 1996 through 1998.
Okay, the black political power at the council level.
Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, it appears.